These will be close approximates to the actual case studies on the exam. Given that we need to prepare for that adequately, I think we'll need time to do it in class. What that means is that I'm just going to suggest 2 dates change, possible change dates for the upcoming exam. I don't think we can make it by Tuesday, so I'm offering Thursday or the following Tuesday. Now, what do we?
Tuesday.
It's 2 weekends. Yes. Bear in mind that we will be finished when we review the target material, so we're not gapping all that time for it. So I heard a rumble. So the choices are not on Tuesday. That's not an option. We won't be ready for it. I mean, I can be ready, but I don't want to do it for you that quickly. Thursday or the following Tuesday? Thursday.
I'm on Thursday. We have to
meet
the day after
that. Yeah. It looks to me like nobody's interested in Thursday. Following Tuesday. How does that sound? It looks like that's your second feature besides attachment that is making it resistant destruction inside the Fager City cell, therefore accumulating inside the Fager City cell, and that can be observed microscopically, and Gram stain. The other aspect is a little harder to determine exactly all the mediators involved and the mechanism. But what happens is that we see the common foci are associated, again not well defined, but associated with a strong inflammatory response, meaning lots of redness, swelling, heat, pain. Those are the four signs of inflammation: redness, swelling, heat, pain. And again, the immune system, those are all very mediators that can trigger that redness, swelling, heat, pain. But nonetheless, it triggers that redness, swelling, heat, pain, or inflammation, and the attraction of lots of phagocytic cells. So the appearance of those phagocytic cells are part of the strong inflammatory response. These phagocytic cells will die in situ, die in that location, releasing their internal enzymes, which will then cause additional damage to the patient. So the phagocytic cell enzymes, which are now released upon their death, cause damage to that part of the body. The body's response to all this will be scar tissue that will build up. This is most notable when we talk about the male urethra and the female fallopian tubes being the site of infection. Both of these are tubular structures. Both of these structures will have scar tissue build up in the walls, and the internal diameters will then contract. That's called stricture formation. So we'll have closing down of the urethra and closing down of the fallopian tubes. With respect to the urethral closing down in the male, they will initially feel that they are super males because they can stand further from the urinal than everyone else. However, it's been transient to the thing because eventually, and that's with repeated infections, because remember we have primarily a secretory response here that does not have a good memory response, same thing you saw in the gut. And therefore you can get the infection repeatedly. And as a result of repeated infections, this stricture formation results in inability to completely empty the bladder. And only a full bladder will have enough pressure to open up the urethra a little bit to get a little bit of urine out, and for a few milliliters, there's not enough pressure anymore and it closes down, which leaves them in a constant urgency to go to the doctor. Not a plentiful place to be. However, there is a treatment for that. It's analogous to a Roto-Rooter procedure. We go in and we hook on the inside of that scarred urethra and rip it out from the inside out. The body responds to that particular procedure is scar formation, which sometimes leads to repeated procedures before we can have a patent or a functional opening for the urine to go through. So the superstar status is transitory, is followed by a lot of more pain and suffering. Okay? So that's in the male urethra. But we notice that part of that story is repeated infections because we have a secretory response that lacks memory. So you can easily see that we're not going to likely have a vaccine for this. For the same reasons we have problems with vaccines on GM tract, lack of memory of secretory response. In the female fallopian tube, it too will close down, and that will result in potential infertility. Well, we're not saying sterility because the female still has eggs. However, those eggs cannot be fertilized in fertility. And oddly enough, for many years, that was thought to be an untreatable, inoperable procedure. So women surgeons came on the field and said, wait a second, we have a two-horn kind of structure, and we can take bits and pieces of functional fallopian tube from either side and create one side that works. And that a lot depends on the amount of damage that was done to the fallopian tube. In some settings, however, when we get into that stage of pelvic inflammatory disease as it extends beyond the cervix up in the fallopian tubes, enough damage can be done that we may have a part of the treatment, maybe a hysterectomy, in which case that would be a more severe outcome. So colic inflammatory disease, about a third of the cases of PID are Neisseria gonorrhoeae, or GC, gonococcus. So we have these rather severe outcomes that are possible. One of the other features that we want to look at as we go through the STDs is what is the interaction between the organism and the pregnant woman? Is the child infected in utero, or is the child infected behind the vaginal liver? And how do we handle that problem? So we need to discuss that clinical situation of a sexually transmitted disease in a pregnant woman and what the impact is on the child. In the case of Neisseria gonorrhoeae, the child is not infected in utero, but is infected at the time of the vaginal delivery. The solution to that is to treat or prophylactically use antimicrobials into the eyes, which is the area that's most likely affected in the child, in the newborn, at the time of delivery. On the assumption that every woman potentially could be infected, every child is treated at the time of delivery. And so the antimicrobials are added to the eyes. Various states have various kinds of specific requirements. We'll get these specific drugs to do this later. But basically, we use that sort of approach. So every child is treated to prevent neonatal problems. The eye infection in the newborn. Now, it's not the only organism that can cause that, because we're going to talk about the others, but that's what we're going to do. Because it's not the only organism that can cause that, we are obligated then to use a broad spectrum antimicrobial agent, not one that's unique to working with Neisseria gonorrhoeae, because there are other agents that can cause that problem. Next organism, Tryptomycin. This is an unusual organism from what we've talked about. It is neither gram-positive nor gram-negative, nor acid-fast. It has some biological characteristics that make it similar to a gram-negative, but it is not technically a gram-negative organism. We use stains such as a silver stain to see it. This is a spirochete organism. The name Tryponema means spirochete or thread. And pallidum means pale, so it's a pale, thread-like organism. Let's step out of the lecture specifics with Tryponema pallidum and talk a little bit about these spirochete organisms, because they cause some unusual problems, but there's sort of a collection of problems that they seem to tend towards. So let's take a look at them. Other organisms that are spirochete that cause problems are Leptospirillium. Leptospirillium causes something known as pre-tibial rash on your shins, basically, right? Pre-tibial rash. Also known as Fort Bragg fever. And some of the immune responses to this additional spirochete, but this beryllium, some of the immune responses to that actually cross-react with Tryptomycin pallidum, which will give us some pause when we do some serological analysis of this organism. Another organism that's a spirochete. By the way, Leptospirillium is not a sexually transmitted disease. Okay. Neither is this next agent. It is a spirochete, but not a sexually transmitted disease. That is Borrelia burgdorferi. Borrelia burgdorferi, also known as Lyme disease. Okay. Now, these spirochete agents, these three, can be chronic situations in which the patient goes through a series of stages. So one thing that we see with the spirochete organisms is we have stages of disease. these stages is often a rash. We often see problems with the central nervous system or peripheral nervous system at the latter stages. And with many of these, there is a characteristic reaction at the point of entry into the body. So there's a characteristic reaction, a lesion, a specific kind of lesion at the point of entry. We'll have a stage that involves a rash, and we have the possibility of nerve tissue being involved, peripheral or central. Those are characteristics of these spirochete organisms. So when dealing with them, we have to realize that we may be seeing inflammation at the first stage of this, and therefore we see the classic lesion to begin it with, or we may see it at a second stage, or we may see it at a third stage. The other thing that's odd about spirochetes, which is something that is more common with multicellular parasites, eukaryotic multicellular parasites, is a phenomenon that's really strange called concomitant immunity. Concomitant immunity, which means if you are infected at one of these stages, you cannot be reinfected successfully. Even so, resistant to reinfection, the initial infection continues to go through its stages. What that tells us is the immune response is a lagging indicator, as the economists would talk about things. So the organism enters our body, it triggers an immune response. But just as the multicellular parasites can do, they will coat themselves with your tissue, hiding the antigens that trigger the initial immune response. So now your immune system can't find the organism, at least not by the antigenic targets that trigger the initial immune response. But if a new organism comes in your body, that trailing immune response will now wipe out any successor infection. Concomitant immunity. So that concomitant immunity tells us that the organism is masking its antigenic determinants, and that's a survival strategy inside it. Okay. So those are broad stroke ideas that are associated with spirochetes. So when we see spirochete infections, we often look at what stage it might be in. We look for a characteristic lesion at the point of entry. We look for the likelihood of a rash at some point in the patient history following that initial lesion, and we look for the possibility of a central nervous or peripheral nervous system problem. We won't go into great detail with this earlier. We'll mention again that it will be here from cross-reacting serology with tryptamine and paludin, and we'll have to deal with that. Borrelia burgdorferi, Lyme disease, named after a city in Connecticut, which a mother insisted that her child and numerous other children that she knew were not a cluster of multiple sclerosis, that they did not have some other kind of chronic disease, that they had something that was infectious, what his mother said. Public health officials told her she didn't know what she was talking about, she was not a professional, she didn't stay out of the job. But persistent over several years, she was able to prove her point. Which means, and tells us again, that these diseases will go on if not treated for a long period of time, and can give you a wide variety of unusual symptoms as it continues to be in your body for a very long period of time. Lyme disease associated with an intermediate host, a deer tick, and so it's associated with a lifespan in deers, and then the deer tick gets infected, and then you get infected by the deer tick. And when the deer tick allows for the entrance of the organism in your body, we have a characteristic lesion at that site called a bullseye lesion, which is erythema migrans, erythema meaning red, migrans meaning moving. So we have an interior spot, this is where the tick bite was, that's red. We then have an area around that is normal skin color. And then we have another band, maybe a centimeter or so, roughly a circle, not perfectly always, of another band of red. This begins out as a sort of a tight circle, and then as it moves on over time, gets bigger and bigger and bigger, leaving a greater and greater area of normal skin tone between the interior white mark and this moving red area, erythema, right migrans. And the bigger it gets, the more sort of unusual, unstable it gets. But initially, all of this can be contained in a centimeter or two, spot in the middle, a little clear area in the redness, and eventually then it will widen out to many, many centimeters, maybe 5, 6, 8 inches across. Okay? So we see that bullseye lesion, as it's called. That's a characteristic lesion at the point of entry. We can then have a rash. After the bullseye lesion fades, we'll have a rash. If this goes untreated, we can have a weakness of the side of the face. We sort of see a collapsing of the side of the face, almost like someone had a stroke. Call that Bell's palsy. And that Bell's palsy will come and go. It won't be simply there all the time. So we sort of see this sagging of the face. And it will gradually get better and get worse again and get better and get worse again. Wax and wane. It'll look as if someone has had some sort of palsy of some sort, that is some sort of nerve problem, and this is one of the agents. And you see that collapsed face there. They may even drool because of the face. It droop, their eye can be drooped out and so on. All of that is characteristic then of Lyme disease associated with this organism, Borrelia burgdorferi. Obviously discovered by a guy named Burgdorf. And it is treatable with antimicrobial agents. It's not difficult to treat. Using protein synthesis inhibitors, we can get all the stuff on that later. But the sooner we treat, we stop it from going to the next stage. If we treat it at the early stage of the bullseye, then we prevent the problems with the rash and certainly the problems with the Bell's palsy. If we wait until we get to the Bell's palsy stage, now we're further down the road. So with any of these kinds of viruses, if we treat them early in the phases, we prevent them from going to the next stage. So again, those Lyme disease is not an STD. But the swirling is not an STD. But there are some characteristic things that we see when we talk about spirochetes. So we've got that spirochete effect on our bodies. Okay, let's apply this now to new power. A spirochete that is a sexually transmitted disease. Lesion at the point of entry is called a chancre. C-H-A-N-C-R-E. Chancre. Sometimes referred to as a hard chancre in comparison to some other STDs that we'll talk about. This chancre is a red, raised, button-like feature. Red, raised, button-like feature. By taking a button, maybe a centimeter or so in size and diameter, and putting it under the skin. So you have this raised aspect to it. It's non-tender. It does not hurt. It appears 3 to 5 days. Again, all these date times are all approximate. Okay? Either exact individual responses. But 3 to 5 days after the entrance of the organism into the body, at the site of entrance into the body. Now, Treponema pallidum cannot penetrate intact skin, but if there's a break in the skin, it can. On the other hand, mucosal membranes, it can penetrate without a break. So we can see these chancres, let's say maybe someone is a dentist or a dental hygienist, and there's a break in their glove, and the person has syphilis and their hands are in their mouth. They can get it that way, and therefore we'll see if there's a cut in their hands, we'll see it on their fingers. Generally just one, you don't get a whole bunch, just a point of entry. shaft of the penis in the male. We can see it on the vaginal wall, the cervix area. We can see it in the oral cavity. The reason to bottle my perverted mind, if it's going to be on the tonsils, it's like 90% on the left tonsil. Go figure that. I don't know why it's not even there. So on the tonsil, okay? So we can see this lesion. We look for it. Now, this is 3 to 5 days in. In the bloodstream of the patient at that time, there are bazillions of organisms. We say it's teeming with organisms. So we look at the bloodstream of the patient who has this chancre, and we have lots and lots of organisms. In fact, the heart chancre itself is friable, that it is breaking, you can break it, and it spills forth lots and lots of organisms. So if it ruptures, there's lots and lots of organisms that come out of it. So we use the expression teeming with organisms. This organism has been around for quite a while, and it's sort of adapted to our psychology, at least that appears that way, if you can add that trait to the organism. Because what happens is that by the time the lesion starts fading away, it's about the time that you think, well, maybe I should do something about this. The plain looking mosquito bite that I got. But it goes away in 5 to 10 days. So that's sort of enough to say, well, I don't know what it was, but it's gone now. I know it was symptoms, and now it's gone. Funny mosquito bite. The next phase appears after a 10 to 15 day waiting, so we have a latency in which there are no signs of symptoms. The person is still fully infectious, but they were even before the heart chancre appeared, they were infectious to other people. And so now they're infectious to other ones, but they have no symptoms. So their blood is teeming with organisms. You now have a secondary stage. So primary syphilis is the chancre. Then we have a first latent period. And now we have a secondary syphilis, and that is a rash. Now when we think about rashes, we look to see, if we push on them on the skin, do they blanch? Does it clear up? Or is it a harder vesicle kind of thing that doesn't blanch? That is, doesn't become white or so? Normal skin tone. This will blanch, so you can push on, it'll be clear. And secondly, we look at what is the sequence? Where does it begin? Where does the rash begin? Typical rashes of measles, and chicken pox and so on begin on the warm, moist areas of the body, the belly, the back, the armpits, and so on, eventually spread throughout the rest of the body. This rash begins at the palms of the hands and the soles of the feet. Well, that's different. So it begins at the extremities, the palms of the hands and the soles of the feet. Then it goes up your arms and legs, and eventually covers your entire body and trunk and head and everything else. So not only do we look at the characteristics of the blanch or not, but where did the rash begin? People generally know, where did you notice it first? It's on my belly. And it wasn't on your arms or face then? No. Or where did you notice it first? I noticed it on my leg. Maybe it's like poison ivy or something. I don't know. I noticed when I was wearing shorts and mowing the lawn. It must be poison ivy. Okay. Maybe not. Okay. So now we have this rash, and it can cover the full body. By the time it covers the full body, it is about 10 days into the rash, and guess what? It begins to fade. It begins fading in the palms of the hands towards the way it came in. Again, the person figures that they don't get treated, they run away, so no problem. The next period of latency can last as short as 6 months to 2 years. Or it could be decades. So we have a 6 month to 2 year latency after the rash disappears. Or we could have a latency that lasts for decades, 20 or 30 years. Third stage, tertiary syphilis, or primary, secondary, tertiary syphilis. Tertiary syphilis is a cell-mediated immune response to parts of the organism that are probably all dead. I say probably, if a person is diagnosed in tertiary syphilis, we will treat. But we don't expect that we're going to kill enough a whole lot of organisms. tertiary syphilis, the immune response is to where the dead bodies of the organism, once teeming in your bloodstream, now have died. As they float through the bloodstream through the body, they get deposited like sand in a river. And they get deposited in certain locations, like bifurcations of a blood vessel. So, for example, the aorta would be a good place. So as the aorta bifurcates and splits and so on, you've got blood going to the right and blood going to the left, and you've got organisms flowing from right and left, and then some hit it straight on, and if they hit it straight on, they spin around and go either right or left. Well, when they spin around, you remember from physics, and you get vector forces. Basically, the vector force drops to zero before it spins around and goes the other direction. So you have them going right, that left, hitting straight on, they spin around, and go right or left. Well, if it spins around and drops the flow rate down, it deposits things there. You might deposit in sand in the river, but now they're depositing organisms. So now they're in the wall of the blood vessel at that point. And now we have, 6 months or 2 years or longer later, a strong T-cell response, cell-mediated immune response to the organisms that are embedded in the wall of the blood vessel, dead organisms, which weakens the wall, resulting in an aneurysm. An aneurysm is a weakened area of the blood vessel wall, but because the pressure is being even all throughout, and this being a weak spot, it balloons out. So now we have a weakened area of the blood vessel, maybe the aorta, ballooning out, which can rupture, and of course, if that ruptures, we're done. An area the size of a quarter blows out of the aorta, quickly fills up the chest cavity in mid-surgery or whenever this happens, and that's not much you can do about that. The other place that we find the organism depositing is in the brain. Now we have T cells response destroying parts of the brain. The neurologists, when trying to assay what the problem is, typically knowing various functions of the body associated with various parts of the brain, typically looks at the kind of injury that you might have had. You got hit on the right side, so you therefore have damage on the right side of the brain, and on the left side is the brain sort of rattled around inside this cranium. So you hit in the front, you have damage in the front and the back, and so on. You can sort of anticipate what's happening. In this case, there is no pattern. The neurological deficits in the brain are random and scattered. The fact that there's no pattern to these deficits is the clue that we're dealing with neurological problem with syphilis, tertiary syphilis. So we have three stages. We have a primary lesion, characteristic of the organism, followed by a rash, followed by a neurological problem. See how it fits into the pattern of the stomach. Not difficult to treat, but difficult to find the person who has the problem because of all these quiet periods, these latencies, and because of the symptoms. I gave you the characteristic symptoms, but in terms of secondary syphilis, person also has sore throats, body aches and pains, fever, they might have the flu. So it's really described sore throats on there. Sometimes on secondary syphilis, we also see white patches on the mucosal surface. White on red looks a little grayish, but they're really white patches. Those white patches are sort of unusual. When the dentist is looking in your throat, and the first thing they do with their gloves on is to sort of open up your mouth a little bit, and they look around this way and that way. They're looking for tumors in your mouth and oral cast cancers and so on, but you're also looking for the little white patches. Okay. A physician who's doing a palpic exam is also going to be looking for those white patches. It might be on the lining on the vaginal wall. Okay. Any clue that might give us that possibility that we're dealing with syphilis. What happens to the child? Well, this is not a very benign problem for a child. If the child is infected in the first trimester, mortality rate is around 90%. Where it will cross the placenta and will kill the fetus, 90% of the time. By second trimester, it's probably around 60-70% mortality. And by the time we get to the third trimester, we're down to 20-30% mortality. But those that make it through, that were infected, being unaffected. So if they were infected, they will be affected by the fact that they would attack the utero. Depending upon what stage of development they were in, various kinds of problems can develop. There can be central nervous system deficits, mental retardation, and so on. There can be blindness and deafness, as cranial nerve damage is done. We also can see problems in the production and deposition of cartilage. So therefore, ears can be malformed or absent. Nose can be malformed or absent. Even kneecaps can be malformed or absent. And finally, we'll see oral cavity changes. Normally, the jawline is roughly a U shape. In this setting, the jaw is the set line of the teeth and the jawline. We're going to see this more of a triangle kind of thing. And so their face is going to be the lower part of the jaw, and so it's going to be sort of narrow in front and broader in the back. It's going to be disfigured there. And the teeth themselves can be altered in normal shape. The incisors and the teeth in the front of your mouth can be hollowed out in the back, so shuffled, maybe a little bit pointed. The molars in the back can be just sort of sometimes it's driven with mulberries, but we don't know what mulberry is, but sort of like a raspberry kind of thing, that is sort of, instead of nice formed teeth, you see sort of bubbles that are hardened in enamel, and they're just the back molars. So the teeth can be malformed, the jaw malformed, ears, nose, absent of the malformed. Significant change, central nervous system problems, mental retardation, deafness, blindness. These are all the impact of the ones that survive. So, clearly we want to treat women who are potentially having syphilis, even by treating the woman, we prevent the spread to the child. Just as we treat in primary syphilis, we don't get secondary or tertiary. By treating in secondary syphilis, we don't get tertiary. So we can stop this in the tracks. And when we do, there is an unusual reaction called the Jarisch-Herzheimer reaction. There will be there. When we treat with an antibiotic such as a cell wall synthesis inhibitor, like penicillin and so on, not the only kind of drug we use, but when we use something that causes lysis of the organism like that, it releases endotoxin-like components. Again, it's not gram-negative, but it's sort of like gram-negative in some of its cell wall constituents, and it triggers a reaction that is fever and chills in the patient. Now, those fever and chills are a result of this endotoxin-like component. And that fever and chill reaction, following treatment with something like penicillin, is going to give us the Jarisch-Herzheimer reaction. It's similar to a transfusion reaction when we give the wrong unit of the blood to a patient. So this fever and chills last for only a few hours, maybe a day at most. As a result of not an adverse reaction to the drug, but rather it is the release of compounds from the organism. It doesn't seem to cause any nasty effect on the patient, but it's something to be expected. So that when we're treating with it, we see the reaction, we go, okay, that's okay. It'll go away. That's expected. Now the diagnosis of this is done besides the physical signs, also serological signs. Oh, one other thing about treatment. You should be aware of the Tuskegee experiment. Did you remember that one? Many people have heard of the Tuskegee experiment. Not nearly enough. All right. You can have to check this one online and go through it. I'll give you the outline of it, the details you can pick up, you should know about. The Tuskegee experiment in Tuskegee, Alabama. Have you heard of the Tuskegee Airmen in World War II? The Tuskegee experiment was, remember penicillin was used in World War II era, discovered earlier than that, then rediscovered by Wachmann and all that kind of stuff. But basically, African-American males in the 1940s were deliberately not treated to see what would happen if we didn't treat them.
Now remember, we had syphilis around for a long time before we had antibiotics. We know what happens. Since the 1400s, we've known what happens. So the 1400s, 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, it wasn't until the 1940s that we began treating, but somebody thought this was a good idea. It was sponsored by the federal government and the local health department. These fellows were deliberately not treated and followed for decades to see just what happened. And they then went through all stages of syphilis, and so some of them gathered the data to find out how many people went this far, and how many people went that far, and so on and such. It wasn't until President Clinton that the federal government really came clean that, yeah, we did this and we shouldn't have done it and we're sorry we did it. That's quite a number of decades that went on without being checked. An experiment on our own population about something that we surely knew what the results were before we started the whole experiment. So take a look at the Tuskegee experiment. It's all kinds of social and medical implications about federal government healthcare delivery, why people don't trust us in terms of delivering healthcare and things like that. Okay, so Tuskegee's done, which is your work. The diagnosis, serological diagnosis. Beginning in the 1920s, we began to try to figure out, could we test serologically for this, and Germans came up with a rather gross but effective way of doing it. All those aborted fetuses were full of the organism, so they used the aborted fetus as a source of antigen to test someone's antibodies. That became rather gross and so on, so we began to try to find out where else could we find this antigen, and someone found that we could also find this antigen in the heart of a cow, what's called cardiolipin, C-A-R-D-I-O-L-I-P-I-N, not lipid, but lipin. So cardiolipin was the basis of the early serological tests. Do you have an antibody to cardiolipin? Different kinds of serological tests, one called a complement fixation assay, which was known as the Wassermann test. W-A-S-S-E-R-M-A-N-N. Probably double letter there. Wassermann test. The complement fixation assay for syphilis. Using cardiolipin. This was then streamlined a little bit, made a little easier. Complement fixation assays have a lot of controls and technician skill involved. So we changed that to a flocculation test, which is sort of a visual precipitation. Antigen antibody come together, form clumps that you can see. And that's called a flocculation. The flock is what you can see. So we did a flocculation test, and that was called the Venereal Disease Research Lab Test, or VDRL. The VDRL and the Wassermann test, two tests based on do you have antibody to cardiolipin. However, there were some problems with that test. People who came up positive who didn't have syphilis. We called them biological false positive. BFP, biological false positive. It was always sort of an anomaly, but didn't worry too much about it. There was a sense of graduate students to play with it to figure out what the problem was. Figured it was nothing major, but it came back with a sort of a strange series of announcements. First off, people who were biological false positive fell into categories like people that had malaria and people that had autoimmune diseases like lupus and so on. Common feature there, there's a lot of post-cell damage. A lot of post-cell damage in syphilis. Which cell damage in malaria and autoimmune diseases like lupus. And then the major discovery was that cardiolipin is a naturally occurring phospholipid in our own membranes. All this while, we're looking for an antibody to something that we already have. What is all that about? Well, it turns out the cardiolipin is on the inside of the membrane and it is not generally seen by our immune system. So when we have something that breaks our cells apart and start seeing something of our cells that we hadn't seen before, we develop an immune response to it. It's a non-specific test for syphilis. It means if you have something that's causing a lot of cell destruction, it doesn't mean you have syphilis. Many people did, and of course if you had the signs and symptoms we described, plus a positive Wassermann test, you probably did have syphilis, but
the actual test itself was not specific to tryptamine tolerance. So to clean up our act a little bit, we needed to develop a specific test for tryptamine tolerance. One we developed was called the tryptamine tolerance immobilization test, or TPI. Tryptamine tolerance immobilization test. If we have a fresh sample of tryptamine tolerance, and we put it on the microscope, and we add someone's serum if we suspect having syphilis, and if they have antibodies to the organism, it will stop the organism from moving in its normal way. Spirochetes have two kinds of movements. One is sort of a circular movement, and the other is sort of a flexure movement. When we add the antibodies, it stops it from moving. Well, that's sort of good, but that requires us to have a fresh sample of the organism, and as it turns out, we cannot grow tryptamine collagen in the lab. So, that's hard to get. We have to be in an area where we have a high amount of syphilis, and every morning we take a fresh sample from someone we identified from the day before, and we use that as a sample for testing today, finding people who are positive so we can use their source the next day, and so on. Not really a practical way of doing it. So we developed a fluorescent antibody absorbed sera test. Tryptamine pallidum fluorescent antibody absorbed sera test. What we do is we take the serum from the patient. This is the standard test now that we've described. Tryptamine pallidum absorbed sera test, fluorescent antibody absorbed sera test. We take the patient's serum and we add to it non-tryptamine pallidum spirochete antigen. So from other spirochetes, other than tryptamine pallidum, we sort of salt it into their serum. Things like leptospirillium, that fourth bag of bacteria. By the way, leptospirillium is associated with mice. Okay? And Fort Bragg has a housing area just like a college town would. And so there's some maybe not great housing that have mice running through it. And as the mice eat your cereal and your roommate says, gee, I haven't had Raisin Bran for a long time. We haven't had it since I was a kid. And you say, what do you mean Raisin Bran? It was cornflakes last night. Okay. So the rogues have got into the cereal and ate it and defecated in it. And now you are eating it. And you're being exposed, but then to their urine, which has brilliant. So college students are not necessarily an unknown quantity relative to rodents in their housing. And you could easily have antibodies to leptospirillium. So now we want to make sure you don't. So we add leptospirillium and other kinds of spirochetes to that serum, and then we'll bind those antibodies to that. Remember, these antibodies will cross-react with syphilis, so we get rid of those cross-reacting antibodies. We centrifuge that serum. We pellet out the immune complexes that were not tryptamine pallidum, leaving only antibodies that are unique to tryptamine pallidum left. That's our first stage. Everybody got that? That's the absorbed serum. So we have all these antibodies, and we remove some by adding the antigen. And it forms a precipitation that we then spin out and meet at the bottom. So at the bottom of the tube is antibodies to leptospirillium and other non-spirochetes in the bottom of the tube there. And in the top of the tube, these are all complexes or antigens. In the top of the tube is just free antibody. We take that free antibody out, the centrifuge. We take the free antibody out, which if you don't have syphilis, there's nothing there. But if you do have syphilis, you have the antibodies that are unique to syphilis. That's the absorbing of the serum, which we're clarifying it. We now have antibodies to tryptamine pallidum. We have a prepared slide with tryptamine pallidum on it, and we add the patient's serum. But we can't see if anything bound. So we need to have a way of an indicator system of did something bind. Well, a unique but strange thing, and you'll find out when we talk about immunology, this is a very common phenomenon, but to you it would be new to you. What we can do is we can take human antibodies, let's say immunoglobulin G, one of your antibodies in your bloodstream, IgG, and we inject a goat. We need a goat in this story. So we get a goat and we inject it. Now the goat has this foreign protein in it, and the goat makes an antibody to that. So an antibody in another body, another organism, student wrote. Well, Ferris, we have a funny nickname for that. And actually, I think it's being used more widely now. We call it an uncle body. It's a bad joke. Antibody and uncle body. So an uncle body is an antibody to an antibody. So it's a goat uncle body. The goat antibody is a human antibody. So we take that uncle body, the goat antibody to a human antibody, and we add a fluorescent dye to it. So wherever it goes, it glows. Now we have two patients, two samples. One is tryptamine pallidum, no antibody because the patient didn't have syphilis. The other slide has tryptamine pallidum with antibody, human antibody on it. The patient's antibody because they did have syphilis. So the reagent slide, now we have the patient antibody. We add the goat antibody to human antibody. It's not the tryptamine pallidum. It will not bind to the negative sample. It will not glow. However, the patient that has antibodies to tryptamine pallidum, who are now bound on that slide, are the target of this goat antibody, and it will bind and glow. So it's a fluorescent antibody absorbed serum test. The essential ingredient there is this goat antibody to a human antibody. We'll talk about these later in much more detail, but they're real, real easy agents to create and use, and they're actually part of the mechanism of certain diseases as well. So, we can identify using a fluorescent antibody test. Now, do we throw away the VDRL test, the Wasserman test? Well, the Wasserman test has been largely replaced because of economics and ease. But the VDRL test is still a good screening test. Because the person who has syphilis will have, in fact, a positive VDRL. And this fluorescent antibody test, you might suspect, is sort of an expensive test. So what we do is we use the non-specific test as a primary screening test. If that comes up positive, we then call in and ask for the fluorescent antibody test. And that will then distinguish that from something else. Now, if the patient has a positive VDRL test and a negative test for syphilis, well, then maybe we're dealing with an autoimmune disease like lupus. We need to know, did they ever have malaria? We need to know more about them to find out why you have that antibody to cardiolipin but don't have syphilis. And again, if we treat, we stop them, so treatment is always key. Stop the progression of the disease. Homophilus capri, we all know the great scale. It is sometimes called soft chancre. So we have a lesion, but this is not the same thing as syphilis. But it is a lesion. Lesion is the result of sort of a funny name, but it's not a funny thing to have. The organism causes the lymph nodes to block. So the organism is growing in the lymph nodes, causes the lymph nodes to block, and as they block, they begin to swell up. An enlarged lymph node that is maybe on the inside of your groin, for example, upper thigh, inside of the upper thigh, or elsewhere in your body, that's a common place that we see. Maybe enlarged to the point where it looks like you got a hot dog under the skin. Is it really large thing, you know, it's maybe 5 inches long or more. It's maybe like an inch in diameter underneath the leg. I mean, this is not going to be a good thing. And the name for that is a fubo. Funny name, but not a funny thing. And this enlarged lymph node, or fubo, you can have those in other diseases, you've heard of bubonic plague. Fubos, again, enlarged lymph nodes. So when you have these enlarged lymph nodes, they can break open. Or erode. Now you have this large lymph node, like a hot dog, that now the top of the hot dog is cracking open. And now you have this lesion. And that's the soft chancre of this particular critter. Homophilus capri. For reasons we're not familiar with exactly, Homophilus capri seems to be influenced by tropical climate. That is, in a more tropical climate, we see more of this than we do in a more temperate climate. Why is the organism somehow sensitive to temperature? We don't know the story on that. This is simply an example of the penicillin A effectiveness with gonorrhea. And you can see that in a 10-year period of time, it went from not being effective to being highly effective to being less than highly effective. Just showing the selection. Some more queries. Chlamydia trachomatis. And your class and your litigant. Both of these organisms can cause sexually transmitted diseases that can lead to infertility. About 15% of couples who try to have children can't. Pretty high number, really, when you think about it. 15% of couples. And when we do the workup on that, we first check the variety, then sort of a checklist, and we check to see, is everybody who they think they are? Do we have a male and a female? We can check that out. We have to check out if they've got all the plumbing that they're supposed to have, and all the organs and tissues, and if they are all functioning, that the eggs are being produced and sperm is produced, you know, all that kind of stuff, that's sort of routine. Once we sort of get past that, could it be something else, and could it be microbial in origin? If so, we can treat this easily. And as it turns out, chlamydia and ureaplasma are common sexually transmitted diseases. Chlamydia is extremely common. Ureaplasma, we don't have good data on. Chlamydial infections are estimated to be someplace between 50 and 100 million people. That's a big number. A sixth of the population is the low side. One out of six. So basically, chlamydia is extremely common. Most often, it is asymptomatic. Occasionally, chlamydia and ureaplasma occasionally can produce a pelvic inflammatory disease in a female. And occasionally, they may result in infections of the prostate and epididymis and so on that are brought to notice by the male. But most often, probably 97% of the time, it's asymptomatic. So we may have 50 to 100 million people infected, but 90% of these people have no signs or symptoms. But one of those signs and symptoms that can occur that they didn't know about is this infertility. It seems to interfere with coming together of sperm and egg. The mechanism of that is not clear. But we can easily treat. And so we treat with using protein synthesis inhibitors. And when we treat, we get rid of the organism, sufficiently lowering the number of organisms to allow for fertility to occur. So protein synthesis inhibitors work quite well with chlamydia, and also ureaplasma. Ureaplasma, the name suggests something. You ever heard another plasma organism? Mycoplasma. Ureaplasma and mycoplasma are family members. They're molecules. They have no cell wall. That's why we use these broad spectrum agents and things to get all kinds of critters. So, chlamydia, ureaplasma can lead to infertility. They're easily treatable. One thing to keep in mind, though, in the male prostate, which may be called anatomy, sort of a spongy kind of structure, and once infected, it's very difficult to clean out the organism. As a result, we can lower the number of organisms sufficiently for pregnancy to occur, but when they want to have kiddo number two, it's likely to find both husband and wife are also infected again and need to be treated again. So in the initial infection and diagnosis and story, when they understand what's going on, they need to understand that every time they want to have a child, it's likely they will have to go through a short course of antimicrobial treatment. So this makes the bedroom conversation a little easier. Because otherwise, the wife is not likely to get infected again on her own, because we can generally eradicate the organism from the female, gets it from the husband again, and of course assumes that the husband was clean the first time and now got infected again, and how did that happen? Okay. But in fact, it's basically that we did not get rid of the organism. The prostate is very difficult to get rid of all the organisms, and so it's likely to be reoccurring in the male again from an endogenous source in his own prostate. A little note about chlamydia, it can also cause eye infections. So we could have that ophthalmia neonatorum caused by chlamydia, that's a newborn infection thing. The mother, in case of chlamydia and ureaplasma, can infect the child at the time of delivery. The organisms do not cross the placenta. So when we do those drops in the eye, where we're treating the antimicrobial agents for the newborn, we have to make certain that we have something that will work on Neisseria gonorrhoeae and on syphilis and on
this ordinance. Remember, those simplest can cross the fence, so that's a little bit different. Across the world, however, chlamydia can cause worldwide blindness, and if it's a sexually transmitted disease, doesn't mean it's always sexually transmitted. It could be by hand, into eye, and so on. And as a result, it results in the scar tissue on the inside of the eyelid, which then scratches the cornea, resulting in blindness. So on a worldwide basis, chlamydia trachomatis can lead to a significant number of blindness. In the United States, the irritation to get is sort of like sand in your eye is usually sufficient to get medical treatment, which when treated early is not particularly complicated. We once did a study on campus where we did students who went to the eye clinic to get diagnosed and treated for chlamydia, or students who went to the health center who had a sexually transmitted disease of chlamydia. We did, on both patients, we did eye swabs, urethral swabs, cervical smears. It's a little awkward for the people that are going into the eye clinic getting a cervical smear, but it all worked out. Okay. And the correlation is very high. So if you have it in one place, you're going to get another. Typically, your hand is where you're spreading it from place to place. You rub it in your eye and so on. Fungal infection, candida. Obviously, candida, the sexually transmitted disease, can be spread by things other than sexual transmission. This is a classic example of yeast infection. There are some interesting factors, though, that increase the likelihood of candida infection, and they have to do with the pH of the vaginal flora. Under normal conditions, we have bacteria growing there, normal flora, that produce acid as a result of fermentation, resulting in an acid condition, slightly acidic. That will keep down the numbers of candidalocans if one does not have an infection. It'll be there, but it's not in any great number. If we do something to change the pH of the flora, then we'll have a candidalocans infection. So there's usually some other factors involved. It could be that we have a diabetic patient in which we have a lot of available glucose, and that makes the balance of fungal organisms and bacterial organisms. It could be that someone has a birth control pill that they're taking that is changing the pH of the vaginal flora, which is then shifting the populations of organisms. It could be that someone has a tumor that's resulting in hormonal changes that result in the pH changes. What I'm trying to get at is that patients should not be encouraged to self-diagnose vaginal yeast infections. Okay? It's easy to take the over-the-counter medication. In fact, there's a TV commercial that a patient run that says, without seeing what's going on, they say, well, you know what it is. You've had it before. When you get it again, go to us and buy our product. It gets rid of this problem. Well, you know, if you've had it before and you're getting it again, maybe we ought to find out why. Okay? To treat this particular infection is not particularly difficult, but if it's returning repeatedly, there could be some underlying concern. It might be a diabetic patient that's not diagnosed. It could be someone with a tumor. It could be someone who's on a birth control preparation that needs to be modulated. So those are all concerns about the patient. Certainly, if we have an immunocompromised patient, they are at increased risk. Getting vaginal yeast infection. So AIDS patients and leukemia patients and all that. So a patient that has repeated infection, vaginal yeast infection, needs to be examined more fully to find out why this is the problem. It's not the problem of treatment, but it could be an indicator of something else. Virulations, herpes simplex, herpes. The word herpes refers to a Greek term meaning to creep along, creeping. And this is creeping along your nervous system, is where it's at. So this organism will invade the nervous system. The typical herpes simplex has two serotypes, 1 and 2. Most oral herpes, which occurs at the mucocutaneous junction between the lip and the skin, that's the nerve ending that's exposed to the organism, nerve, the trigeminal nerves, and so on.
That herpes is typically type 1, someplace between 70 and 90% type 1. And general, and that's usually a single lesion, single blister when you get it. General herpes is usually type 2, about 70 to 90% type 2, and usually results in several nerve endings, so we have then a several rash, several points of lesion. All of these lesions will be similar in their effects. There will be a prodromal or a preceding burning sensation. That's an indication that the nerve ending is now producing virus. That will be followed by a blister formation, which is part of your immune response to the organism. Almost like an allergic reaction in some cases. And so we have that immune response, allergic reaction to the organism. That forms the blister. In that prodromal or burning period of time, you are shedding the virus. During the blister, you shed the virus. And the blister lasts for a variable length of time, from 4 days to maybe 10 days. During the time of the blister, you are shedding the virus and infectious evidence. The blister then dries up and heals and goes away. For a period of time, up to maybe 2 weeks or so, after it's gone, you are still infected to evidence. You're shedding the virus, as we say. Now, for most people, that's about all there is. And for most people, it's the infection rate, for example, on type 1 oral herpes, seroconversion is about 85% by age 15 or so. The other 15% are probably non-responders. They're infected, but they're not producing the antibody they're looking for. So we assume the general population is about 100% infected with herpes simplex. But most people do not have repeated problems. Most people may have an occasional problem once every year, or once every 5 years, or maybe once every 10 years. Not really a big issue. Some patients, particularly immunocompromised patients, will have repeated infections, sometimes on a monthly basis. In those settings, we can use a cyclovir, oral cyclovir is our best effect. When we first developed, we thought maybe we could do this as an ointment or something, but this is not a very effective kind of thing. Now, when we use the cyclovir, we decrease the shedding time, and that's our concern. The blister also disappears a little faster, but this is not all that significant in terms of what's happening. So it's about a day shorter, but if it's something that you're just having on a monthly basis, and there's potential problems elsewhere in the body, this may be something we might consider doing. But for the average person who gets it once every couple of years or something, it's not really practical or needed. If a person is immunocompromised, however, it's a much more severe infection, spreading throughout the bloodstream. In that setting, we're going to use an IV cyclovir instead of an oral one. And the IV cyclovir is very, very effective in getting rid of the organism throughout the body. Unfortunately, after we use it about 3 or 4 times, we start selecting for thymidine kinase resistant, or these resistant organisms. And the organism starts using our enzyme instead of its own enzyme, and guess what? The cyclovir doesn't work. So we develop then a pattern of different kinds of a cyclovir-like drug. And we start using those, and they're effective for a few times, and so on. So we see this immunocompromised patient that has a systemic infection. We will begin the treatment, but bear in mind that this is not something that we can use forever, that we're going to have to switch off it after about a year or two and do something else with that patient. If you're selecting for resistance by using the drug. The same thing we do with bacteria, we do with virus. What about the child? The child infections can be more severe. The child is exposed at the time of the vaginal delivery, not infected in utero. The child's infections generally enter in through the eye. Occasionally, the child will have an oral cavity infection. Normally, we don't see that, because the receptor sites of the virus disappear in the first 3 months of life. But a newborn may have an oral cavity. You know, you have
blisters that appear on the inside of your mouth. There are other viruses. There's something called vesticular stomatitis virus, or VSV. That's the typical one that causes you little canker sores and so on in your mouth and so on. That's not herpes, except it could be herpes if you're just newborn. So for the first 3 months, it could be. So if a child has got those lesions at the time of delivery, or shortly after the time of delivery, really, within maybe 2 or 3 weeks, then that's a sign that it may have. Also, we're going to see central nervous system deficits. And that's really hard to pick up in a child. They can be very minor. Significant impact on the child, but symptomatically minor. That can then lead to an encephalitis. That can lead to blindness and deafness. So this can have really nasty outcomes. But even those minor ones that did not resolve, they were birth problems, but were infectious, we think do lead to mental retardation. So Johnny can't read in fifth grade, could be because Johnny was infected with herpes simplex as a newborn. So we really like to avoid this problem. The one way of doing it is to have a C-section rather than a vaginal delivery. So if a woman has a history of having herpes simplex infection, we find that in those patients who have serious infections, about 1% of the time, when they're not shedding, they're not having a recent infection, they don't have any burning sensation, everything seems fine. About 1 day out of 100, 1% of the time, they're actually shedding the virus. So that's a scary term. So what we are doing is we're really considering the C-section as something to deal with, to avoid the child infection. Now, if someone doesn't have a history of it, we don't worry about it. But if you have a history of repeated herpes simplex infection, even if there's not a lesion at the time, increasingly we're opting for C-section. If there is a lesion, and there's been a recent one, we clearly go for the C-section. Okay. Now, we don't want to do, we want this planned, a planned C-section. We don't want to do an emergency kind of C-section. That is, we don't want to do this after the placenta has ruptured, the water has broken. Well, by that time now, the fetus is being exposed by washing back of the placental fluid. And so, you missed it. And sometimes physicians will still sort of push the kid back up and out a little bit and then do a C-section. And that's still a little bit late. We want to do this before the rupture of the membrane. There we go. You can see the cycle here, so it's an analog to winding. So again, you get more of that in the freezer. Okay. Hepatitis B, C, and D are sexually transmitted diseases. Okay. Blood and blood problems. Remember, A and E were not. So now we're going to go through and do all that hepatitis stuff. Okay? These are slides coming from the World Health Organization, and we're going to modify them a little bit because some of them are a little misleading for our general population. But most of it is pretty good. A and E, you see, are fecal sources, so that will lead to fecal-oral route transmission. So A and E, you see, is going to be contaminated water. Notice that A and E do not have chronic infection associated with them. The viruses do not integrate into the genome. In the case of A, we can immunize. So we have a vaccine. And we have pre- and post-exposure immunization. What they're referring to here is pre-exposure means using an antigen, a vaccine. So we have a vaccine. And we stimulate the immune response in the patient. That's called active immunity. Post-exposure is we give already made antibodies. We give you antibodies that are already made. That's a post-exposure immunization, and that's called passive immunization. So active, the patient makes their own immune response. We give them the antigen ahead of time. Post-exposure is when we use already made antibody. Those antibodies will be effective for a period of time of less than 3 months. They will disappear. And then you have to get them again. So given a foreign and outside source of antibody, that's something that's a protein that has a half-life, where actually we give you the antigen, you make your own antibody, that's lifelong, or at least many, many years of protection. For E, which is not very common in the United States, a vaccine has not been developed, either the antibodies or the antigen. Okay. And it's just a matter of, we don't see it, we don't have a problem with it, we don't develop it. You have a problem in another part of the world, it's your problem, you develop it. It's not a cat, it's sort of a trash kind of thing, but that's basically the way we do things. We have a lot of money, and we do a lot of things, and we do it for our own selves, and if it helps somebody else in the process, that's fine. But if they have a problem that's just theirs, and we don't like them to get it, well, we're not so humanitarian in our nature. So we could develop fine, it could be developed, the areas where we get this, don't do it. Okay? So they just say, you know, get good drinking water, and you won't have a problem. Okay. We'll talk a little bit more about A. We'll show you the pictures of the family pictures and so on in a moment. B, C, and D are blood and blood products, sexually transmitted diseases. They enter in through membranes and across the placenta. They can infect people through sexual transmission, through exposure to blood. In an emergency room, somebody has it, blood flashes in your face, get it in your eyes, you can get it that way, or wear shields and all that kind of stuff. Chronic things are possible. The organism can integrate into the genome, resulting in chronic infection. For hepatitis B, we have the antigen for active immunization and the antibody for passive immunization, so pre and post for hepatitis B. For C, we do not have immunizations. We have not yet developed an effective way of doing that. So we talk about behavior modification and treating blood donors so we don't give it to one person or another accidentally. Now, B is a little misleading. It's not incorrect, but what it's saying is not necessarily what you're going to infer from it. It says pre and post-exposure immunization. That is true. But what happens is it's not an antigen that we're immunizing against the D or an antibody to D. D is a defective virus. You cannot get D unless you already have B. By preventing B, you don't get D. Okay, so all of you have been immunized against B, so you're protected against D, the defective virus. So it's not a vaccine unique to D, but rather it's the carryover effect of this being a defective virus. And therefore, if you're immunized against B, you're protected against B. It's the twofer idea. Some estimates, again, this is just a rough estimate. Hepatitis A, we have 125,000 cases a year. That's over a 10-year period of time. It really hasn't changed much in the last 10 years or so. So that's roughly the number of cases that we're getting with A. Few people will die of A, but not many. So we have 200,000 cases, and we have 100 people die. Again, not a chronic problem. Most of the people here are getting it through contaminated water. They're eating raw shellfish. Okay. And so we say don't eat oysters and months that have that don't have an R in it. From. Those are the months of the year that we don't have high populations of people visiting the tourist areas, flushing their fecal material into the water that's been picked up by the bottom of and the bottom of the water, and they concentrate the virus that way. Then you eat it raw shellfish, okay, oysters, clams, that sort of thing, and that's a common way of getting it. If the month doesn't have an R in it, then it's like May, June, July, August. Those are seasonal areas, times of the year, when there's lots of people crowding around and the sanitation system is not keeping up, and we have any contamination of the water that surrounds it, and of course, we have contamination of the shellfish. But September and October and so on, we can certainly do that. Okay. Hepatitis E, we don't see much in the United States, so we don't have a category about it. Right? Hepatitis B, we see again slightly higher. Not
major hire, there's why they hire in every case for 2 years. A little from more people die from the death. So look at the county infection. It went from none to a million a year. And hepatitis C, 3.5 million a year. And even D gives us 70 million, if you remember the D is a subset of the D. So this is a major problem. What about deaths to chronic liver disease? Thousands. These are patients that would be potential candidates for a transplant. They're not necessarily high candidates for transplant because they're likely to infect that new liver. So it's a bit of a problem. So the number of cases is dwarfed by those that enter into the genome and cause chronic infection. And hepatitis C, for which we have no immunization for, big problem. Family picture, hepatitis A, nothing like that. This is what it looks like. You can see the distribution in the world. You don't memorize that. But just recognize that, you know, we're not too high for hepatitis A. But if you travel in Africa or Asia or South America, you are traveling to a place that's not Kansas. Okay? So when you travel to these areas, the water is likely to be contaminated. So you're likely to get exposed. And so what you're likely to do is call the old microbiologist and see if he's still there. I get called a couple of times a year from pharmacy students, pharmacy students, and so on. I'm going to do a mission work in wherever, you know? And I didn't do my hepatitis A immunizations. You know, what can I do? Well, you can use the antibody, the passive immunization, and that will protect you for, you know, a few months at most. So if you're just going to be there for 2 weeks, get the shot before you leave. But you know, the next time you might want to think about getting the actual vaccine with your own antibody. Hepatitis A is one of the areas where we're going to do some modifications. Close personal contact. I will agree with that with the World Health Organization. So if a young child, for example, reservoirs, big time, children, reservoirs, diapers, problem. Okay? And so we have household contact. Daycare centers, yes, I'll go with that, diapers and so on. Sexual contact, no. What this is, what they're referring to here, is not something that's unheard of, but it's not, it's the hearing horse association thinking of a zebra first. It's possible, we're not going to consider it as a reasonable answer on an exam. Basically, this is anal sexual contact followed by oral sexual contact. You can get the drift of that. So that's how you're going to get it. Okay? So anal sexual contact, oral sexual contact, that kind of thing. Yes, those things I'm sure people do, but it's not a common way that people get it. Okay? It's much more likely to get it from a child or from who's infected or getting it from raw oysters or something like that. So you can draw a line through the sexual contact here in terms of the answer that we're going to look for in an exam. It's such a small likelihood compared to the sexual transmission of B, C, and D, where we really have a problem, that I don't want you to confuse that. Contaminated food and water, you bet. Okay. And blood and blood exposure, I'm going to say we're going to draw a line through that one as well. What they're saying is if a person has hepatitis A, and they give a transfusion to someone, they can give hepatitis A to someone else. I will agree with that, except for the fact, yeah, you can get measles that way, you can get influenza that way, anything that's in their bloodstream you can get, okay? So that's really not necessarily the same kind of rate of transmission that we'll see with hepatitis B, C, D in terms of transfusion and drug abuse. So this is another very rare. They say rare, I'm going to say very rare. I'm going to draw a line to that for our examination purposes, okay? It's a minor footnote, but I want you to get the sense of proportion. Not a common phenomenon. The rationale would be you don't say you get chicken pox that way. It's the same way. The kind of A incubation period is, don't memorize the time so much, but it's roughly a month. Okay? And that's roughly a short period of time. Jaundice. Now, this is a good one to know because we tend to think hepatitis with jaundice, that is yellow in the skin and yellow in the eyes and so on. Indicating liver problems, right? Look at this. We have Shantas, under the age of six. Remember I said the kids and the diapers are a big source? They're only 10% of them have jaundice. So they don't, that the jaundice test there to see if you've got problems fails miserably. And even if you get adults, it's only 70-80%, and that's a good number, but it's not 100%. So jaundice is not really a good indicator that you have a liver problem. Many people who don't have jaundice still have a liver problem. Complications, this would be resulting in a rapidly culminating disease course, and it's not that common. It can develop, but not very common. And again, getting something, a chronic situation, is not likely. Doesn't integrate into the genome. And when you look at some of these charts, and these charts, you do need to know these, okay? At least a couple of them. This first one you need to know. Here we have a period of time in months after exposure, and the titer meaning the concentration of what we're looking at. In this first case, we're looking for virus in the fecal material, and notice the virus in the fecal material occurs someplace around 2 weeks after exposure and before the development of symptoms. Okay. So that means that you are shedding other people, you are infectious to other people, before you know you're sick. That's an important observation. And then once the symptoms begin, your likelihood of infecting other people starts diminishing. So by the time they start staying away from you, they miss it already. Now, there's a little overlap at the beginning of the symptoms and the end of the shedding of virus and the material. The alanine or other kinds of transaminases, the transaminase levels, they are a marker of something going wrong relative to cells being lysed. Generally, when they're laying around outside the box, someone took them out and figured that out. Anyway, so the transaminase levels are elevated, and that simply means that we have damage done, in this case, to the liver. But it's not unique to the liver. We would find elevated transaminases in patients that had a heart problem, a heart attack. And we have heart cell dying. But that is consistent with someone that has a problem in the liver as well. But notice that they're elevated and then they disappear. And they're disappearing at the same time that we're producing these antibodies. Our first antibody is IgM, immunoglobulin M. Our second antibody, not marked here, but you can add it, is IgG, our memory response. And the way the World Health Organization pictures this is total antibody. So total antibody is IgM plus IgG. But you can see that the IgM is disappearing. So our total antibody here is the same. This is all IgG. Excuse me, this is all IgM up here. And then it starts splitting off. The difference between these two lines is the amount of IgG. So by the time we are 5-6 months out, it's almost 100% IgG. So again, this blue line is total. Initially, it's all IgM. Ultimately, it's all IgG. The difference between the two lines is the amount of IgG. So as the antibody rises, the virus disappears, symptoms go away, and you get better. Community outbreaks, again, we talked about children being the reservoir. 5 to 14-year-olds have high rates of getting infected. Persons at risk, travelers, yes. Draw a line through homosexual men. Draw a line through IV drug users. Again, not because it doesn't occur, but other types of hepatitis are far more common. I don't want you to be confused with it. So for our examination purposes, we'll draw a line through those groups. We told you how it can happen, but that's not the common mechanism of getting hepatitis sexually. Hepatitis E. You see hepatitis B down the picture. You can see where it is, not to memorize it, and so on. Incubation period is a little longer, still about a month. No chronic problems, but one thing to note about hepatitis B: pregnant women are at risk. Fatality rates of 15 to 25%.
this virus is taking advantage of the immunosuppression that occurs selectively in pregnant women. Remember, we'll go more detail when we go to the immune system, but remember, the 9-pound baby is like a 9-pound tumor. It's only half like the mother. Why doesn't the mother attack it? Because the mother is being somewhat immunosuppressed. You see the same sort of risk associated with H1N1, because some pregnant women are on the high risk because of the virus, in this case, H1N1 and here, type B, is taking advantage of that inability of the mother to fully respond. And it depends on the antigens that the invading organism has, whether that is going to be an effective strategy. Again, you can look at these. We're not going to dwell on this one. Again, it's not that common in the United States. It's the same sort of thing. You see the virus. You see the symptoms. We have antibody response. Hepatitis B. Notice the family picture. See, we've got these long, thin kind of structures. We have these round ones. And if you look at this round one, you can actually see like an inner line. Can you see that? We're going to talk about the core antigen, and that's in here. And we're talking about the surface antigen, that's on the outside. So the core antigen, hepatitis B core antigen. Sometimes students will take a hepatitis C virus. No. Hepatitis B core antigen, the C antigen is internal. You can see where it's highest. Okay. We noticed the Inuit population in Alaska and Canada, along the coast of Greenland, the Amazon Gulf area, Sub-Saharan Africa, and Asia. But again, not to memorize the map. Here's another one of those maps where charts that were put out. This is by the CDC. Well-meaning, but no, they really don't say what they say they say. Take a look at this. We're trying to figure out who's a risk factor. Okay, IV drug users? Yeah, we can do that. Heterosexual people? Okay. Homosexual people? My goodness, we just about everybody's either heterosexual or homosexual, right? And then we all the way down. We have a whole category of other, unknown. We have 31% unknown. The whole rest of the chart is becoming very suspicious. So you have to look at these and see a legitimate chart. This is not made to make fun of. It's funny. It's sort of strange. Also note down here sexual contact. We're talking about multiple partners. Some people consider themselves monogamous because they only have one partner at a time. When they ask questions about multiple partners, they're thinking of threesomes and foursomes and things like that. Or at least Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, a different person. But if they have the same person for 1 month, then they switch off to another person for the next 2 months. And if they do this throughout the year, they've had many contacts, but they can say, no, they only have one. So when people are answering this question, it's often sort of a little bit strange. That is the incubation period. 60 to 90 days. So this is longer. We were talking roughly a month before. Now we're talking a couple of months. So that's a period of time in which there are no symptoms. Jaundice. Again, you see that same pattern. Children under the age of 5, only 10% or less. And even when you're greater than 5, it only goes up to 30 to 50%. So jaundice is not a good indicator of whether or not you're at hepatitis B as well. Fatality rate on the acute phase, it's low, it's there, 1% or so. Chronic infection. This is an important observation. Under the age of 5, you're much greater likelihood of having a chronic infection. The younger you are, the closer you are to the 90%. Over the age of 5, chronic infection is much less of a problem. And basically, one of the mechanisms of death of chronic is liver failure. And this is 15 to 25%. Now, included in this 15 to 25% of liver disease is liver cancer. So people will die of liver cancer. People will die of something called chronic active hepatitis. They get it and they never get over it. And that usually results in death in some place around 10 to 12 years or so. The reason it takes so long is that the virus is integrated into the genome, but remember your liver can regenerate. So your body is trying to create new cells which then become new targets. And eventually you get to the tipping point where you can't keep up with the destruction. Now that's going to occur with any time we have B, C, or D. So one of the things we want to think about in anybody that has hepatitis B, C, and D, and the possibility of chronic infection is there, is they have to be really careful about their liver. Therefore, they have to avoid alcohol. They have to avoid spray painting cars for a living. They have to avoid being exposed to all kinds of toxins because they can't handle that. Yet normally, the liver would be able to regenerate any damage there, or at least some of it. Quite a lot for patient alcohol. Eventually, it does get temporary. But the idea is that these patients have to handle their liver very carefully because they are at a very high risk of going to liver settings. And the more they damage their liver by other things, such as alcohol and so on, the greater the likelihood that failure will come sooner. Now, this is an institute chart that amplifies what we're talking about in terms of chronicity. At birth, 90%. So if your mother has hepatitis B and it crosses the placenta, which it will, you will be born with hepatitis B. 90% of the people born with hepatitis B are chronic infected, meaning they have an increased likelihood of long-term infection, 25% mortality rate, and so on. That's why we want everybody universally immunized, so everyone will be protected, and we won't have pregnant women who then give it to the children. That's an important observation. Again, a major deal in terms of immunization. The older you are, up to about age 5 years of age and so on, it's less. So as our immune system matures and our first exposure occurs after the age of 5, it's less likely to be integrated into our genome. And also note symptoms. This high rate of infectivity with chronic integrated into the genome, and there's no symptoms until you're a year older more. And even then, it's not a very great number. That means a lot of these children whose mothers are hepatitis B positive are infected chronically and no symptoms, at least initially. This chart you should know. Know it cold. I will ask questions on it. You will have questions on it. Patients will talk to you about questions about it. This is important. Lots of information on it. Okay, let's take a look at it bit by bit. We start off a period of time, about a month or so, after exposure, where we cannot find any detectable antigen in the patient, and they don't have any symptoms. But they still have the virus, which is going to be detected. By 4 weeks or so, they start having increasing amounts of the virus, as demonstrated by hepatitis B surface antigen. An antigen on the outside surface of the virus. So hepatitis B surface antigen, meaning that they have the virus, and they're getting it and then giving it to people for injury, to the bloodstream. Then in about 12 weeks, that sort of peaks. And then the antigen disappears gradually over the next 6 months. Meaning the virus is disappearing gradually. Now the virus inside the cells is not going to be neutralized by any antibody, so when it comes out, it's going to meet an antibody and then it's going to be neutralized. So that's why it takes a while. The ones inside the cells keep popping out, but eventually they disappear. So antibody is taking care of it. And the antibody that's taking care of that, neutralizing hepatitis B surface antigen, is the antibody of hepatitis B surface antigen. Okay? And that's starting to rise up at about 32 weeks. Where was it before? Well, actually, it began someplace around 12 weeks. It is that antibody that's causing immune complexes to appear, antigen-antibody complexes, neutralizing the virus. And that's why this is dropping off. But there's no free antibody. This represents free antibody. So here we have free virus, disappearing, and ultimately free antibody arriving. This period of time between the disappearance of the virus and the appearance of the antibody to the virus is known as a window period. Early ways of determining whether a person was infectious, for example, via the transfusion, was we look for the antibody to hepatitis B surface antigen over here, and we say, well, I'm sorry, you've had hepatitis, we don't want your blood. Or we look for the antigen over here, the immune complexes, and they are still infectious. So we have a problem with our testing system. We missed the people early on, and we missed the people in the middle. So we corrected for that. We look for antibody at the core. Antibody at the core. Okay. Now, notice the total again. That's antigen IgM and IgG. And this one over here is the IgM to it. So this is the antibody at the core, first antibody. And the difference between the two lines is the IgG. So now what we do is we look for hepatitis B surface antigen and antibody at the core. We don't look for antibody at the surface antigen. Not really meaningful for it in this setting. To find out if you are a potential donor, can we use your blood? If either of those are positive, then we don't use your blood. If you have symptoms, you notice where the symptoms are, they occur when we're going to be positive for the antigen. So we still have a period of up to 4 weeks where a person does have the virus in the bloodstream, will give it to someone if they in fact are blood immune to a transfusion. What do we do for this? Well, we try to ask a lot of very strange questions to people who want to be really nice people and donate blood. Okay. We ask them, have they had a recent tattoo? If so, you're not. What? Have you traveled to another country? You're out in the last 6 months or so. Have you had sex with other men? You've had multiple partners. Sex with sex toys. There's a whole bunch of questions that are asked, and people find it intrusive, but they need to know, were you at risk? That's all we're trying to find out. Were you at risk? And that's what that whole battery of questions would also take your teeth and your temperature to see if you have a fever, but again, symptoms aren't going to be troubled, and so we'll put it anyway. And then, of course, they would test your blood. And if the person asking the question senses, even though you answer the question the way they would like you to answer it, but they see and sense that maybe people pressured into it, they're not really sure, that it's out. So the blood can be tossed out even on the hint of something. And if you think about it, you think, well, most people aren't even one of those risk factors. I haven't traveled to India lately or something. Look at the number of college students who get tattoos. They're out. Okay. You have a recent tattoo, even if you had any tattoo, you're probably out. Etc. Because that's one way to get it. So the number of people that are increasingly that are eligible to get blood is decreasing over time. This is one of the problems we have with this. Finally, we have another antigen antibody system up here. Antibody to E. Antibody to E, antigen, is correlated with a significant drop in infectivity to others. Presence of the antigen to E is correlated with infectivity to others. So we see that that infectivity drops off as soon as you have the antibody, and in most cases it's going to be correlating with the disappearance of the antigen, the B surface antigen. Now if you were, so we can use that for infectivity, if you were immunized, what would it look like? Well, you would have the antibodies to the surface antigen. So those of you that are immunized, you have this, okay? If we test your blood, you're not going to have the antigen. You're not going to have the antibody to C. Because C wasn't in that preparation. So you'll come up okay, even though you've been immunized against C. Okay. So you need to be able to distinguish a person that's been immunized from a person that hasn't, and a person that's infected at various stages as to what kind of serology we'll see. And understand that window period is an important part. Now what about the people that integrate? They have a chronic infection. Well, they have a different pattern. First off, they're infectious. They still have the E antigen. They don't have the antibody to E. And this goes on for years. So these people with chronic active hepatitis have infectivity as part of their lifestyle for years. And following long enough, 10 years or 8 to 10 years or 12 years, they may start developing antibody to E and they become less infectious to others. Do they have the virus? You bet. Antibody to the hepatitis B surface antigen, they have that. They don't have the antibody to the hepatitis B surface antigen. They have the antigen, they got the virus. Do they have the antibody to C? Yeah, they get the antibody to C, but notice the antibody to C is not protective. It's a marker of infection, but it's not infective. The protective antibody is the antibody to the surface antigen, and they don't have that. They have the antibody to the core, which is a marker, but that's not infected. So we can distinguish a person who's not been infected from one that's been infected, from one that's been immunized, from one that's been chronic active. So we have four different possibilities. Those are things that you should know. Age of acquisition, you can look at this in terms of when you get what. Again, the key feature here, the younger children exposed, the greater likelihood of getting infection. Body fluids, where they can get them, obviously blood, serum, wound exudates, looking at someone's wound, or bruising from an arm or leg or wherever. Semen, vaginal fluids, saliva, all have the virus in it. Not likely to be a problem, and I'll agree with most of this list. Urine, certainly not. Feces, not. Sweat, not. Tears, not. Breast milk, we're still working on that. Okay. It's probably okay, but there is a concern of spreading it from an infected mother to the child. It's up in the air. Data before you decide it. It's probably not a problem, but it theoretically might be. Okay. Whereas urine and feces and so on, clearly a problem with hepatitis A, not a problem with B. You can see that we decrease hepatitis B by vaccine, by developing vaccines, by improving our surveillance of transmission. Perinatal transmission to prevent this. Again, we need to immunize everybody and so on. We talked about nothing unusual that you couldn't be aware of. Hepatitis B, Delta virus. B is defective, but that's against the Delta. Notice that the virus, the risk co-infection, actually has hepatitis B surface antigen as part of its structure for that co-infection. You can see where it's at, below the end. Co-infection, that's the key thing. Of course, when we have two viruses invading the liver at the same time, that leads to a super infection and increased likelihood of very severe outcomes in the liver. And you can see the chart. Don't worry about this chart particularly. There's nothing that's unusual there. Same thing with super infection. I wouldn't memorize this one. And even though somebody has been on this one, just realize that we have hepatitis B surface antigen here all the time. You can see the C. For hepatitis C, incubation period in a sort of middle range, it's roughly a month and a half or 2 months. Only about 20 to 30% will develop jaundice. Clinical illness, only 30 to 40%. Chronic infection, 70%. Note that very high chronic. And persistent infection, meaning you have the virus in your bloodstream, 85 to 100% of people. Once you have hepatitis C, you see we got it. Okay. And you're going to keep it. And right now, we have no way of protecting you against C. That's why even though you've been immunized and protected against B and D, C is still fair game for you, and if there is a concern about chronic infection. So that's why we want universal protection. And we'll talk about a little bit about C, and then we'll go on to